the summer of 1991, 500,000 units, than they had sold in all of 1990, 400,000 units. And the best part was that with each Genesis sold, the consumer would typically buy more than 3 games per year. No, strike that. The best part was that each sale of the Genesis likely meant one less sale of the Super Nintendo. You were either a Sega person or a Nintendo person. You couldn't choose both. Video games were quickly becoming a religion, and luckily for Sega, the company was offering a 16-bit console that could be worshipped today, while Nintendo system wouldn't be accepting prayers until early September. "This year is going to be good," Kalinske said. "Next year is going to be great, and I don't know what adjective will describe the year after that, but I'm honestly thrilled to find out." "I think you're absolutely right," Race said. "And I'd like to be at Sega for a while. But every time I start to think this is the right place for me, I run into some bullshit with the Japanese that makes me want to quit on the spot." "Don't let that stuff get to you, Steve. I can help with SOJ. Believe me, I already know how much shit you shield us from. I don't know how you put up with Nakayama and his cohorts, but I tip my cap to you. Come on. Can't really believe that your dislike of the Japanese..." "It's not like that. I'm not racist or anything," Race broke in. "It's the whole culture. It's the passive way they do things. It's the fact that when I come into work in the morning, it's not uncommon to discover that they've made a decision in the middle of the night that cancels out everything I did yesterday." Kalinske shook his head, disappointed but unable to fully disagree. Nakayama had certainly given him the leeway to do things his way, but many of his decisions still led to unnecessary battles, even if they did work out in Sega of America's favor. "I admit that it can be tough at times, but when push comes to shove, we've always been allowed to do things our way. Just look at the Genesis. They let us drop the price, they let us put Sonic in the box, and you see how well that's going." "I do see that, and I think it's great," Race said, unconvinced. "But did you ever wonder what they think when they see Sega of America doing so well? In my experience, stories about the haves and the have-nots don't end too well." The situation between Sega of America and Sega of Japan was hardly as dire as Race insinuated. But there was certainly a noticeable difference in recent sales results. Sega of Japan had chosen to give Yuji Naka, Sonic the Hedgehog's chief designer, a few additional weeks to fix any kinks, and then launch the game in Japan in late July 1991, 1 month after Sega of America. In addition to the delay, the other notable difference was that in Japan, Sonic did not come included for free with the hardware. The game was sold separately for 6,000 yen, and though it quickly became Sega of Japan's best-selling software title, it paled in comparison to Sonic Mania in America. The first week Sonic the Hedgehog was released in Japan, it sold 7,178 copies. The next week it held steady at 7,062 copies, until the following week sales dipped down to 6,086 units. By the end of the year, Sonic the Hedgehog would eventually become a hit in Japan, but not the mega hit that it was in America. And because the game didn't come with the hardware, it didn't dynamically increase the installed base. Though it was rare to hear anyone at SOJ acknowledge the sales disparity, when they did, they attributed the weaker results to Nintendo's iron grip over retailers, a lack of third-party support, and the subtle ways that SOA had altered Sonic to work in America and not in Japan. "It's not a matter of haves and have-nots," Kalinske said. "We're one company, and the better we do, the better they do. Besides, Nakayama is thrilled by how we're doing, and his is the voice that counts. Trust me, Steve, this is gonna work. And when the roads get rocky, we can lean on Shinobu for help." "Shinobu? Their spy? Pfft, don't get me started on him." "Fine, fine," Kalinske said. "Why don't we table the issue for a little while and focus on less abstract matters?" "I thought you'd never ask," Race said. "What's next?" "Do you remember a doll named Dawn?" Kalinske began, though we could immediately feel Race's interest slipping. "Anyway, I think we should run a promotion where customers can turn in their old NES and get a brand new Genesis."
"I love it."
"Yeah? Absolutely. But I'm fairly certain that's illegal these days, pal. And I'd go to war for you, Tom, I really mean it, but not jail." "Damn. Kalinske replied, and then tried not to appear too deflated. Then let's talk about the Sega World Tour. The Sega World Tour, Kalinske said with an optimistic smile. This was Nilsson's big idea. To convince anybody still waiting for the SNES that it was time to stop that nonsense and buy a Genesis, he dreamed up a nationwide 30-city mall tour. Much like at CES, the goal was to set up a side-by-side comparison between Sonic and Mario and let players decide which game was better. The Sega World Tour? Race echoed, rolling his eyes. Huh. Maybe we should go back to discussing the many merits of working for the Japanese. What? You don't like Al's idea? Kalinske asked. The idea is excellent, but the execution is a nightmare, Race said. He was right. The dare-to-be-bold idea looked great on paper, but it was positively hellish to actually put together. Different cities, different mall managers, and different setups posed challenges, which were compounded by the fact that to truly steal Nintendo's thunder, the events of the tour should take place at multiple locations on the same day, which meant different crews and multiple equipment rentals. Nilsson had an undeniable talent for thinking big, but what Kalinske needed right now was for Race to take Nilsson's oversized thought bubbles and transform them into something real. Execution is certainly the issue, Kalinske said. So, can you think of anyone that we can hire to be our, executioner? Let me think about that, Race said, before suddenly becoming distracted by the baseball game on television. The Giants were still winning by a run, but now the Dodgers had a runner in scoring position and a hot hitter at the plate. Kalinske followed Race's eyes to the television and eagerly watched the at-bat. Strike one, strike two, and then Race threw Kalinske for a loop when he said, "Let's go, Dodgers! Come on now, single here brings in a run." What? I thought you were a Giants fan. Nah, Race said. I root for whoever is losing. So if the Dodgers take the lead, then you'll root for the Giants again? What can I say? I like comebacks and exciting endings, Race said. Strike three. Like many in the bar, Kalinske emitted a tiny yelp. Race, however, just shrugged, his mind already spinning on something else entirely. For the Sega World Tour, I have an idea about the job. EBVB. EBVB? Kalinske asked. Is that a person, place, or thing? Week 13. EBVB. Few people know that Lake Tahoe's Squaw Valley was decided the 1960 Winter Olympics. Even fewer know that it has a base elevation of 6,200 feet, a vertical rise of nearly half that, and an annual snowfall of 450 inches. Ellen Beth Van Buskirk, however, knew all of this and much more. She knew that there were 26 chairlifts and a state-of-the-art gondola, and that not only had it hosted the 1960 Winter Olympics, but also that those were the first Olympic events to be televised. She even knew that the broadcasters had freaked out because there was no snowfall until the week before the games began. When it came to Squaw Valley, EBVB knew it all. It wasn't that she was a devout skier, her sports were basketball and distance running, or some kind of skiing trivia savant. But as marketing services manager of the brand new resort at Squaw Creek, she felt compelled to memorize everything there was to know. A lesser manager, or a less neurotic individual, might have been content to know that many of these facts were safely tucked away inside a brochure somewhere. But Van Buskirk felt more secure when information was locked up in the vault inside her head. It was more challenging this way, more like a game. And that helped reduce the reality that her life had come down to filling 405 rooms at a ski lodge. She had grown up in an era where it was considered more adorable than ambitious for a woman to work. She always found that notion ridiculous, and took pride in never just wanting a job, a place at the table, a spot on the team, but wanting the top job, the best seat at the table, the starring role on the team. True, she rarely got the and often had to settle for an A, but the no-no-no of the status quo didn't extinguish her fire. She developed a precocious talent for spinning negatives into positives, and interpreted her 5-foot-11-inch frame to be the Lord's not-so-subtle way of telling her to keep thinking big. No matter how many times the world tried to teach her that she was lucky just to participate, she never stopped trying to teach the world that it was flat-out wrong. Until now, perhaps. Van Buskirk hadn't quite given up, but there were signs. She heard her own voice quieting, saw her worldview blurring. To her, moving to Squaw Valley meant raising the white flag. Throughout 1990, she had been able to do her job from an office at the Rincon Center in downtown San Francisco, where they had a small street-level retail storefront decorated by photos, sketches, and a massive architectural model of the resort, so large, in fact, that it had to be placed in the office before installing the windows, because the doorway was too narrow. In 1991, however, the resort had opened to the public, and they wanted Van Buskirk to move out there permanently. She thought the mountain was beautiful, but dreaded the move because she believed San Francisco to be the center of action. Unfortunately, however, there didn't appear to be any other option besides occasionally staring at the phone and willing for it to ring. Eventually it did, and it was Steve Race. "What are you up to?" he asked. "Oh, you know," Van Buskirk said. "Everything, nothing, and the occasional something." She had known Race for nearly 5 years now, and he still had a knack for both impressing and bewildering her with his brashness. They had met back in 1986 at Worlds of Wonder, when she was learning the ropes of the public relations game. He used to say that big things were in her future. She didn't know if this was just something he said to everyone, but the way he said it made her believe it was true. "I'm not up to much. Just home, watching TV, thinking about going for a run." "I meant more generally," he said. "Job-wise." "Ah, okay. I'm managing a ski resort in Lake Tahoe." "Oh," he said, seemingly as surprised as she was that that was her job. "What about the rah-rah ladies' PR agency?" Race was referring to Van Buskirk, Morris, Webster, and Smith, a firm that she had formed in 1988 with three other female rising stars in the PR industry. It had begun with the best of intentions, but had come apart a couple of years later amidst mistrust and finger-pointing. Van Buskirk wasn't too pleased about how the agency had fallen apart, which explains why Race didn't know that it had. "What happened with that?" "Oh, long story," she said with a familiar sigh. "But the short story version is that women are crazy, myself included."
"I could have told you that,"
Race bellowed. "I could have told myself that," she replied. "Oh well, lesson learned."
"You sound borderline convincing, E.B., he said. "Anyway, this is good. Well, not for you, but for me. I need your help."
Race went on to provide a brief overview of Nilsson's mall tour, and then sold her hard on Sega, using many of the facts that Kalinske had been using on him. "I realize that the job is below your pay grade, but we're about to give Nintendo a run for their money, and who knows what happens next."
"What's the name of the company again?"
Van Buskirk asked. She couldn't believe it. Amazingly, an opportunity had come along at the 11th hour, but why, oh why, did it have to be with a company she had never heard of before? The only thing she feared more than moving to Squaw Valley was taking a job with a company that would be extinct only a few months later. And even if the thing did work out, she was quite sure that mall tour organizer didn't exactly pop off a resume.
"Can I think about it?"
"Think about it? What are we, Greek philosophers?" Race retorted. "I prefer you talk about it, Lady Socrates. I'm setting you up on a lunch date with this Nilsson guy."
"Okay, cool," she said, relieved.
She thought the world of Race, loved how he can motivate people to walk through walls for him, but knew that he tended to charge in and out of companies, either because he'd grown bored with the lack of challenge or had worn out his welcome. As a result, she realized that even if she decided to join this Sega place, there was a chance that Race might already be gone. So she was happy to meet with someone who likely went through life and jobs in less of a hurry than Race did. Nilsson met Van Buskirk for lunch at a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco's South City. Before going, he was given explicit instructions by Race to reel her in. Nilsson felt confident in his metaphorical fisherman skills, but wasn't sure that he'd need to use them.
He urgently wanted someone to help bring his mall tour to life, but was uncertain that he and Race valued the same qualities in a potential employee. Race was aggressive, impulsive, and unapologetic, leading Nilsson to half expect that he'd be meeting someone who looked and sounded just like Race, but with a ponytail and painted fingernails. She was, happily, nothing like that. Van Buskirk was elegant, insightful, and self-aware in the best way possible. Not self-conscious, but gracefully conscious of herself. If Race ran through life as if it were a sprint, Van Buskirk moved with a well-measured marathon approach. After an exchange of names, biographies, and small talk, she handed Nilsson her portfolio, which was mostly filled with stuff about Squaw Valley. He opened it, scanned through it in a matter of seconds, and then handed it back to her. "That bad, huh?" she asked. He opened his mouth to respond, but then decided not to, curious if this would ruffle her feathers. Nilsson liked testing people in small and strange ways, believing that most of life was small and strange, and that things like this revealed a lot about a person. She didn't seem bothered whatsoever, already happily discussing the etymology of the term duck sauce. "I thought it was such a strange name," she said. "Soy sauce is made from soy. Hot mustard is both hot and made of mustard, but duck sauce?" Nilsson inspected the tiny bowl of orange sauce. "I venture to say that no ducks were harmed in the making of this sauce." "My thoughts exactly," she said. "So I went to the library and looked this up. Turns out that in Hong Kong and southern China, whenever you order roast duck, it comes with this sauce. They give it out to mask the gamey duck flavor and also hide the occasional taste of fat. So even though it's actually made with pickled plums, sugar, vinegar, and occasionally pickled pits, they called it duck sauce, and the name just stuck." Nilsson was impressed. Not only did Van Buskirk crave answers to the most wonderfully inane questions, but she actually went the extra mile to get answers. From there, he bombarded her with a barrage of questions. The more he liked what she said, the harder the questions got. He didn't want good. He wanted awesome. "What's the best place to start the mall tour?" "You want me to say New York or Los Angeles," she said. "But I'd opt for somewhere close to Nintendo. Seattle, maybe?" "There's a mall in Bellevue, Washington," he said with a smile. 5 miles from Nintendo's headquarters. Since initially conceiving the idea, Nilsson had added some flourishes to his master plan. For one, he wanted to open the Sega World Tour in his competitor's backyard. Another change was that he didn't just want mall-goers to see Sonic versus Mario and get the point. He wanted that point to be reportable and irrefutable. To accomplish this, visitors would not only play both games, but also be asked to vote on which was better. "Players enjoy Sega's 16-bit system at mall" would have made for a nice story, but 80% choose Sega over Nintendo would be a headline for the ages. With this alteration to the plan, whoever ran the mall tour would not only have to serve as executioner, but also arrange for a judge and jury. After lunch, Nilsson met with Race to talk it over. They agreed that she was overqualified for the job, but both thought that she was wise enough to see the potential of Sega. After a pleasantly awkward moment where both men realized they were in a rare state of complete agreement, Race gave Nilsson the green light to hire Van Buskirk. "What about approval from Tom and Paul?" Nilsson asked. "No problem," Race said. "I already spoke with them." "When?" Nilsson asked, not quite sure when that could have happened, but happy to have the answer he wanted. "Don't worry about it," Race said. "We're good." Nilsson set up another meeting with EBVB and started off by handing her a small box. "What's this?" she asked. Again he ignored her, and again she passed the test she didn't know she was taking by opening the box with curiosity as opposed to caution. Inside was a big fishing lure. She turned to Nilsson, not knowing what to make of this. Nilsson sported an isn't-it-obvious smile. "I've been told to reel you in." Van Buskirk laughed, then smiled, and then did both at the same time. There was no logical reason to join Sega, but then again, there was the fishing lure in her hand, and the fun, puns, and blissful insanity that it no doubt symbolized. How could she resist? Week 14. Rolling Thunder. From his office across the hall, Kalinske couldn't make out many of the words between Al and Paul, but he could hear the thunder of their conversation. Al wanted money for something, and Paul was responding in his normal, frigid, frugal manner. Normally, Kalinske didn't mind hearing Ryo's bad cop routine, but today he didn't want to deal with any distractions. With the Super Nintendo launch just around the corner, time was feeling less like an abstract concept and more like a noose. He knew that they needed to have a new commercial ready soon if they wanted to avoid being hung. He had been working with the ad guys at Bozell, but continued to be less than pleased with their work. They were good guys with good ideas, but the days of good enough had burned away with the summer. Kalinske thought about switching agencies, as he had been reluctantly greenlit to do by Nakayama and the board of directors in Japan. But a proper agency review takes months, and a good chunk of money, two resources that Sega couldn't afford at the moment. What they could afford, just barely, was a head-to-head against Nintendo. There was still a decent chance that Japan would pull the commercial after Toyota revealed what Sega of America had planned. And there was also a chance that Nintendo would sue them for showing Nintendo products in their ad. But Kalinske was intent on moving forward with an ad they referred to as the Salesman. In the spot, a pushy salesman ferociously tries to hawk the Super Nintendo to a customer who keeps getting distracted by the many benefits of the Genesis. Cheaper, faster, etc. Though he felt that Bozell's execution was a bit hokey, he believed that it did the trick of throwing down the gauntlet at Nintendo's feet. With the what, where, and when coming together, his remaining concern was the who. Whom did Sega want to identify as their ideal customer? The teen wearing the leather jacket? The jock wearing the sweaty uniform? The curvy college co-ed? Kalinske was contemplating this and looking over the storyboard when he heard footsteps approaching his office. It was probably Ryo, headed his way with someone's head on a platter. Or maybe it was Nilsson, bursting in with another idea about how to get Nintendo's goat. Or maybe it was Race, pissed off by another roadblock in his way. Unless it was Burns with new Sega of America sales data to send down to Walmart, or Toyota with new Sega of Japan sales data and a grenade of disappointment they'd have to fall on, or maybe it was... anyone. That was the answer Kalinske had been seeking. Nintendo wanted kids, but Sega wanted anyone. And that's exactly what the commercial should show. If the ad was shot from the perspective of the customer, then the customer would be anyone. The teen, the jock, the college co-ed, and millions of others. The ad that Bozell had readied accomplished this perfectly. Though the salesman in the ad looked like he'd graduated from the University of Used Car Salesmen, by having the customer be no one instead of someone, Sega's ideal customer would be anyone and everyone. As the commercial went through post-production, Sega of America worked on a plan to deploy their head-to-head missile. For budgetary reasons and out of fear that Japan would pull the plug, they developed a strategy called Rolling Thunder. Instead of evenly broadcasting the commercial over several weeks, or spacing it out for a slow build of momentum, they would air it as much as possible at first, and then sporadically after that. Start with a bolt of lightning, make sure everyone notices it, and then reinforce the message with smaller thunderclaps in the following weeks. Well, assuming that Shinobu Toyota could successfully hold off Sega of Japan. Week 15. Coke versus Pepsi. The moment of truth was upon him. For months, Toyota had been watering down information and finagling reports to Nakayama and Sega of Japan so that he and his colleagues could proceed as they saw fit. This was true not only in regard to the new commercial, but also when it came to Sega of America's unabashedly aggressive attitude in general, CES, the mall tour, and so on. Now, however, with the Super Nintendo about to be released, and Sega of America's plans too far along to be stopped, the time to come clean had finally arrived. It was just after midnight, and as usual, Toyota was the last one left at the office. He searched for a comfortable position in his desk chair, and prepared for his nightly update call to Nakayama, who would just be waking up. Toyota was not one to assume the worst, but given Nakayama's tendency to be temperamental, he knew there was a chance this could be his last day at Sega. He looked around the office, filled with Sonic mementos and photos of his family, and felt good about all that he had done. If he wasn't fired outright, there was also a chance he'd be recalled back to Japan. If so, he'd likely be forced to endure the cultural practice of Murihachibu, in which a dissenting employee is overtly shunned by his colleagues until it is decided that he's paid the price for his transgression or has appropriately demonstrated his loyalty. Whatever the outcome, Toyota had decided that he would not let this deter his American dream. No matter what, he would find a way to stay in America, provide for his family, and elevate himself through effort, excellence, and entrepreneurial spirit. Toyota called up Nakayama and spoke clearly and confidently, revealing everything as if he had just now learned of these details. Once it was done, he instinctively adjusted the collar of his shirt, bracing for the worst. It was all out in the open now, and even as the ensuing silence chipped away at Toyota's confidence, he regretted nothing. This was America, the land of opportunity.
"Very interesting," Nakayama said in a perky tone. "Those are good ideas."
"You think?" Toyota asked, unsure if Nakayama was being sincere. After all, Sega's head honcho had a flair for the dramatic, and nothing made for better drama than building someone up before watching him fall.
"Most certainly," Nakayama explained. "I have just finished reading this great book by Mr. John Sculley, who is now the president of Apple, and before this he was the president of PepsiCo. He talks at length about making bold moves to go head-to-head against market leader Coca-Cola. Our Sonic against Mario. It is very much like the taste test challenge that he describes."
"Oh, yes," Toyota said.
"I can see how they are similar."
He was so relieved that he was amazed he can even speak. Nakayama was not always the easiest man to deal with, but at this moment, Toyota felt overwhelmingly fortunate to be working for him. He was a rare breed. One of the few Japanese business leaders who not only had an admiration for Western business tactics, but was willing to admit it. With Nakayama in Japan and Kalinske in America, Toyota saw no reason that Sega would not dominate for decades to come. Week 16. After the summer comes the fall. Shortly after Toyota's surprising conversation with Nakayama, Kalinske enjoyed an unexpected one of his own. He was in his office reading the September 2nd issue of Forbes. Well, not reading so much as rereading the same sentence over and over. "We don't regard Sega as a competitor in the U.S., Nintendo's Yamauchi had said in a recent interview. Kalinske chuckled at the words, then began to read them again when he was interrupted by a call from Walmart's electronics merchant. And, as was always the case, the man spoke with the level of stress-induced grouchiness that Kalinske had nearly come to appreciate. "My nemesis," Kalinske said, sitting upright. "To what do I owe the honor of receiving a call from the beloved 501 area code?" In addition to sending Walmart a packet of sales reports and news clippings each week, Kalinske had been calling the merchant to share marketing plans and product development information, attempting to walk the fine line between persistence and pestering. This was no easy thing, particularly in light of the fact that he'd never acknowledged that Sega had been trying to take over Bentonville, Arkansas for almost a year now. The endless struggle sometimes got to Kalinske, and on his worst days he viewed himself as Don Quixote, pathetically tilting at windmills with a sword made of rubber. Still, despite the occasional doubt, something deep inside him welcomed the challenge. Kalinske had never tried so hard to get a retailer on board, and as a result, he had never wanted it so badly. "Did you get the latest figures I faxed? Look," the electronics merchant said, interrupting without remorse.
"We give up. We'll carry Sega. Just close that damn store already and stop all the advertising in Bentonville. My boss and his boss are driving me crazy with questions about why we're not carrying the Genesis, and I can't take it anymore. You win."
And just like that, Sega was in Walmart. Not all stores at first, just initial test regions. but where the product was sold mattered less than the fact that it was being sold at all. If mighty Walmart was carrying Sega products, then other retailers had no excuse not to do the same. The curse had been broken. It had been a long summer, but things were really starting to come together. Electronic Arts enjoying their most profitable quarter to date, and Nakayama had recently persuaded Acclaim to risk Nintendo's wrath and start publishing games for both systems. It was only a matter of time before all the third parties followed suit. And any retailers, third-party publishers, or consumers who remained unconvinced of the future that Sega promised would be swayed soon enough. If not with games or advertisements, then by EBVB's execution of Nilsson's fantasy.
"You did it,"
Nilsson said, smiling like a proud Papa Bear whose cub had just swiped his first fish out of the water. He was standing toward the front of a rapidly growing crowd as Sega's side-by-side world tour was getting started at the Alderwood Mall in Seattle. In the center of the hubbub, below a giant Genesis banner, was a black-on-black stage set up with several stations for people to discover the difference between Sonic and Mario. In just a few moments, kids, teens, and adults of all ages would be invited to step right up and see for themselves which 16-bit system was worth buying. "It's like you found a secret portal into my mind, took photos of my imagination, and then brought what you saw to life in a way that actually made sense." Van Buskirk put an arm on his shoulder and nodded with pride.
"Busted."
After Seattle, the mall tour would go on to hit 24 malls in 16 cities, converting the masses from Peabody, Massachusetts to Torrance, California. To get even more mileage out of Sega's avant-garde traveling circus, Nilsson sewed up a partnership with Nickelodeon to borrow their cool and start encroaching on Nintendo's grip on 6 to 12-year-olds. Nickelodeon, the number one kids' television channel, would be running Where is the Sega Tour Now spots throughout their programming, and also run a promotion called the Slime Time Sweepstakes, where viewers could win Sega products if they answered questions correctly live on air when randomly called by a television host. This was what Nilsson loved most. Taking a big idea and stretching it bigger and bigger until it enveloped the world. After he brought on Nickelodeon, EBVB recognized the immense opportunity and was granted permission to hire a new PR firm to help rebrand Sega. She selected Manning, Selvage & Lee, MSNL, whose Sega efforts would be led by Brenda Lynch, a peppy publicist with the compulsive habit of getting others to see the world in whatever shades of gray that she thought were appropriate. Lynch took it upon herself to make sure that everything Sega did, made, or thought would be seen by the world in the context of Sega versus Nintendo, hip versus lame, new versus old. Kalinske hoped that with so much momentum behind it, the mall tour would prove to non-gamers what video game players were quickly discovering. Sega was a force to be reckoned with. The new price point of the Genesis seemed to have hit a consumer sweet spot, and the incredible launch of Sonic the Hedgehog had given Sega the Mario killer they had so badly craved for years. Well, that was true in America, at least. In Japan, Sega's 16-bit sales were improving, but they were still unable to reach more than about 10% of the market. Kalinske was a bit troubled by the disparity, but figured that if push came to shove, then Sega of Japan could always just follow Sega of America's blueprint for success. Aggressive pricing, aggressive marketing, and unrelentingly aggressive employees who refused to rest until Nintendo had been toppled.
"Wait a second,"
Nilsson said, pulling Van Buskirk away from the hoopla in progress. 10 people had already tested out both consoles, and 8 of them chose Sega.
"Is that who I think it is?"
Van Buskirk squinted and couldn't help but cackle.
"I realize this kind of makes me sound like a witch," she admitted. "But if ever there were a time, right?"
Lurking behind the crowd and moving with the slow stalk of a shadow was a familiar face. It was Nintendo's Peter Main, and he did not appear to be particularly amused. Chapter 19. The Enemy of My Enemy. In October 1991, Minoru Arakawa was asked under oath if he considered the inventor of Sonic to be a genius, on par with the likes of Shigeru Miyamoto, who had created Mario, Zelda, and other classic games for Nintendo. Arakawa looked around the San Francisco courtroom and carefully considered the question, though there was a lot on his mind. This trial, for one thing, had become a nuisance. The litigation between Nintendo and Tengen had been dragging on since 1988. After the infamous reverse engineering incident, Nintendo had sent letters to retailers such as Toys R Us and Bradley's, threatening legal action against anyone who continued to sell unauthorized NES-compatible game cartridges. Tengen responded by suing Nintendo for unfair competition and violations of Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act for the alleged monopolization of the video game console market. Nintendo countered by bringing a suit against Tengen for patent infringement, breach of contract, and RICO violations. Beyond compensations for damages, Nintendo sought an injunction that would require Tengen to remove its unlicensed games from stores. Though it had been 3 years and there was still no resolution, the litigation had effectively crippled Tengen. The legal issues weren't Arakawa's only problem, however. They were annoying, yes, especially the corrosive manner in which they dragged on and on. But the more pressing matter was the Super Nintendo. It had been released on August 23, 1991, and in only 2 months, Nintendo of America had already sold 500,000 systems. Though the numbers appeared to be strong, they were falling slightly below the initial forecasts. This angered Yamauchi, who had grown accustomed to expecting nothing but the best out of his son-in-law, especially following the frenzy that the Super Famicom had stirred in Japan. There were two reasons the American launch had failed to replicate the excitement found in Japan. The first was an issue of public perception. Nintendo of America had known that the lack of backward compatibility would be a problem, but hadn't anticipated the scope of the backlash. Around the country, parents reacted as if they had just discovered that Nintendo was operating some kind of electronic Ponzi scheme. This outrage prompted a carousel of newspaper headlines like, "Parents say Nintendo isn't playing fair," Kansas City Star. "Nintendo game plan infuriates parents," Atlanta Journal. And, "Parents vow to resist onslaught of new, more costly Nintendo," Patriot News. Parents weren't just upset by the compatibility issue, but also irate that Nintendo didn't sell a converter that could resolve the compatibility problem, especially when such a device was being sold by Sega, who presented the other major obstacle to Nintendo's American launch. For $35, Sega sold something called the Power Base Converter, which allowed games designed for their 8-bit Master System to work on their 16-bit Genesis. Even though very few people owned the Master System and the Power Base Converter was hard to find in stores, Sega flaunted the fact that such a device existed as proof that they cared more about their customers than Nintendo did. It quickly became Sega's most valuable, if worst-selling, product. The converter, however, was only the tip of the iceberg when it came to Sega. The much bigger problem was Sonic the Hedgehog. The character had been only a mild success in Japan for Sega's Mega Drive, but was an instantly adored phenomenon in America. It was as if after a decade of conservative politics under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, Sonic's combination of speed, attitude, and energy seemed to embody the promise of the 1990s. Although Minoru Arakawa would never admit it to Kalinske, he wouldn't even meet with Sega's president, nor ever voluntarily proclaim it in public, on the witness stand he had to tell the truth.
"Yes," he said. "They looked at Super Mario. They wanted to come up with something similar."
After answering, all he could do was sit there and wait for the next question. There would always be more, it seemed, because this battle with Tengen would never come to an end. Later that month, Kalinske flew to New York City with Nilsson, Toyota, and Burns. With the holiday season approaching, they all had a lot on their plates, but for the next few hours, they would have only one thing on their minds. Tengen. After touching down at JFK, the four of them hustled through the airport with their carry-ons, sneering at the suckers who had checked bags, and flagged down a heavily dented yellow cab. As Kalinske got into the passenger seat, his three employees took deep breaths and thought thin thoughts in order to fit into the back seat. We need to go to the Coliseum in Columbus Circle, Kalinske told the driver, before taking a mental photo of Nilsson, Toyota, and Burns all crammed together. And at the risk of sounding like a movie cliche or worse, a tourist, feel free to step on it.
How are we doing on time? Toyota asked out of breath. Bordering on screwed, Burns replied.
Nah, don't worry about it, Kalinske said in his breezy manner. We'll be fine. Besides, they won't start without us.
Nilsson looked out the window, his eyes taking in the towering buildings.
We've done all we can. Our fate is now in the hands of Trafficles, Nilsson said.
When the others didn't seem to get it, he elaborated.
You know, the Greek god of gridlock.
Kalinske, Toyota, and Burns chuckled, which eased somewhat the anxiety they'd each been feeling. Nilsson had a real talent for detecting tension and knowing how and when to diffuse it a little. It was a skill that had proved to be quite valuable at Sega over the past few months, when things had quickly gone from calmly good to chaotically great. By July, word of Sega had started spreading throughout the country, among consumers and business executives alike. By August, customers who had been holding out for the SNES started giving in to their 16-bit desires and purchasing a Genesis. And by September, retailers were experiencing periodic stockouts. To keep up with the increased demand, the company had to grow quickly, not just in terms of facilities and number of employees, but also creatively and in the employees' mindset. More people, more press, more games. It would have been a nightmare if it all weren't so wonderful. Proof of success could be found in the little things, the speed at which calls and faxes were returned, the respect, unspoken but visible on people's faces, when you told someone that you worked at Sega, and the unexpected moments when you were in line at the supermarket or video store, and some random kid was explaining to his parents how important it was that he get a Genesis for Christmas. All of these things were more than just a pat on the back. They served as a push on the shoulder to keep Sega moving faster, faster, faster. Sega now had its foot in the door, but Nintendo still owned the house. Kalinske was willing to try anything as long as it didn't go against the Sega narrative that he was trying to sell to the world. Fun, scrappy, edgy company revolts against the tyrannical status quo and brings entertainment to the next level. Naturally, the idea of jumping into bed with an enemy of Nintendo fit right into his mission. So he was not all surprised when Toyota came to him expressing a desire to work with Tengen. At the behest of Nakayama, Toyota had been testing the waters with Tengen CEO Dan Van Eldren. On the surface, a relationship between Sega and Tengen made a lot of sense. Sega needed more games, and Tengen could provide great titles. Below the surface, a relationship between both companies made even more sense. What the public didn't know, and what Kalinske had just found out, was that Nakayama had been helping out Tengen behind the scenes for years. In an effort to weaken Nintendo, he had offered financial resources to help foot their mounting legal bills. Kalinske wanted to know how long this had been going on. He also suspected that Sega might have even been the reason that Tengen had reverse-engineered the NES in the first place, but he knew he'd never find out for sure. Getting straight answers out of Nakayama was like catching a shadow and pulling its teeth with a needle from a haystack. Kalinske respected his boss greatly, but hated the fact that he'd been at Sega for a year now and still felt like there were secrets hidden behind every door. Still, there was no use fixating on something he couldn't control. And even with the occasional corporate surprise, Nakayama had been true to his word, granting Kalinske the autonomy to run Sega of America as he saw fit. Besides, in this case, Nakayama's penchant for chicanery had worked out to his advantage, as Sega had signed a very favorable deal with Tengen. As New York whizzed by outside the windows of their cab, Kalinske, Nilsson, Toyota, and Burns scrambled through files and folders to review talking points for today's joint press conference with Tengen.
Which sounds bigger? Burns posed. Tengen will be making 40 games for Sega over the next 2 years, or Tengen will be making 20 games per year for the next 2 years.
Forget it, that sounds redundant.
Territory question, Kalinske put in, flipping through a folder. Nothing in the language with regard to Asia, right?
That is correct,
Toyota said, not needing to consult any notes. He knew this deal through and through.
It applies only to America and Europe.
If you feel the need to mention a title off the cuff, Nilsson said, scanning a partial list of Tengen's games, I would go with the RBI baseball series. The Pac-Man stuff is great, but I think it'll come off as old hat with this crowd. Kalinske nodded, now reviewing his speech. Even though it would be short and sweet, the text was sharp, witty, and well put together. Kalinske had gotten help from Ellen Beth Van Buskirk, who had been lending a hand to PR endeavors, and would be staying with Sega after the mall tour to run communications inside the company. The mall tour was almost done, and the results showed that bringing her into the fold was a no-brainer. The Sega World Tour had already reached over 100,000 people, with 63% of that audience being children and teenagers. Of that total, 88% chose the Genesis over Super Nintendo. In addition to the staggering results of Sega's taste test, articles about the showdown in major national and regional newspapers were on pace to reach 10 million people. Van Buskirk was most definitely a keeper. With a small smile on his face, Kalinske reread the opening to the speech she had helped write and nodded to himself. She's real good.
Who?
Toyota asked, always alert.
Ellen Beth,
Nilsson said, knowing exactly whom Kalinske meant.
EBVB.
Nilsson had immediately recognized that she was a star from how cleverly she had brought his vision for the Sega World Tour to life, to the way she could speak at length to anyone from any walk of life and never sound like she was talking up or talking down to them.
She was incredible at the malls, Nilsson said. She just gets it. She really does.
She's making a dent, Kalinske said. Next time we should bring her along.
Definitely, Burns echoed. That is, you know, if she isn't busy hobnobbing with the world's greatest athletes.
The others laughed. EB had done such a bang-up job in her first couple of months at Sega that SOJ had entrusted her with an important assignment, or at least something they considered to be a top priority. With SOA making a name for itself, some of the folks at SOJ decided to play a game of anything you can do, we can do better. So they stepped into SOA's sandbox and searched for a splashy marketing opportunity. As lovers of golf, they looked into sponsoring an event on the PGA Tour, but that turned out to be pricey and difficult to procure. Instead, they decided to sponsor an LPGA event in Atlanta. When Kalinske found out, he thought it was a prank. Beyond the LPGA's lack of popularity among the general public, Sega wasn't even selling a golf game, let alone a women's golf game. But before he or anyone else at SOA could intervene, he was already done. And EB, a former athlete who had demonstrated an ability to pull off unusual events, was put in charge of this one. The first annual Sega Women's Championship would tee off on April 19th, 1992.
Jeez, Kalinske said. I sure hope a good excuse to skip that LPGA event crops up between now and then.
After a nod of camaraderie, they returned to their last-minute homework for the press conference. Kalinske would be the only one of them speaking, but he wanted everyone to do as many press interviews as possible. So they all poured through the information they had on hand and made sure they had a few quotes ready. They made it to the Coliseum on time, and it was a good thing they did. The lavishly decorated room was filled with a large crowd of journalists, financial analysts, and potential investors. Tengen was rumored to be seeking a round of additional capital. The event was kicked off by the two men that Toyota had been negotiating with, Dan Van Elderen, Tengen's tall CEO, and Ted Hoff, their bespectacled executive vice president of sales and marketing. After they proudly announced a strategic alliance with Sega to produce 40 games, Kalinske came to the podium and uncorked a bottle of his steely enthusiasm. The content of the speeches that day was secondary to the visual of Nintendo's rivals shaking hands, though Kalinske made waves of his bold claim that Sega was already outselling Nintendo. Whether this was true or not was a matter of debate, but it foreshadowed a contentious game of numbers that Sega and Nintendo would play over the next few years. Following a series of photo ops and press interviews, Kalinske and company went out for a round of celebratory drinks with Van Elderen and Hoff. The Tengen guys were a lot of fun, and it was nice to clink glasses and speak in the buzzed, conspiracy-laden hush of new friends with big, bold plans. Nintendo was in the crosshairs, they decided, and would finally get what was coming to them.
"How's the never-ending trial going?" Kalinske asked, sipping a beer.
I'd be more than happy to bitch about it, Van Eldrin said with a grumble. But unfortunately, we're not allowed to discuss the proceedings. I will say, however, that it was funny to see Arakawa have to share his thoughts about Sonic under oath. After a gurgle of laughter, Kalinske checked his watch and announced that he had to step out for a few hours. You have a date? Hoff asked. Kalinske nodded to his guys, who knew where he was headed. A big one, he told Hoff, and then said his goodbyes. Before leaving New York, Kalinske had another one of Nintendo's enemies to meet with. Someone with a little more muscle than Tengen. Sony. A few months earlier, Kalinske had received a call from Olaf Olafsson, who was at Sony's ImageSoft offices in Santa Monica. Olafsson had wanted to meet Kalinske, and with the feeling being mutual, they agreed to get together for lunch. They bonded over their outsider status in the video game world, as well as a mutual love for honesty, innovation, and unconventional ideas. Thanks to their similar personalities, it was quickly evident that they were destined to be friends. The only question that remained was whether or not they would also be business partners. Olafsson offered Kalinske a standing invitation to meet with him and his boss, Mickey Schulhoff, the next time he was in New York, which turned out to be for the Tengen press conference. The three of them decided to meet for dinner at the private club atop the Sony offices at 55th and Madison. Kalinske entered the white-facaded building and took the elevator all the way up to the 37th floor, where Olafsson and Schulhoff were waiting for him. Right on time, Olafsson said, flashing a half-smile. Tom, meet Mickey Schulhoff, and Mickey, say hi and be kind to my friend, the incomparable Mr. Kalinske. A pleasure, Schulhoff said, extending a hand. He was a handsome man with perfectly parted hair, a tan, and a bright white smile. Though a soft handshake might have suggested that he was another of the dime-a-dozen pampered executives, he glowed with a gritty, omnipotent confidence. I've heard way too many great things about you from Olaf, so I already know they can't all be true. I like it when the bar is set high, Kalinske replied. Otherwise, what's the point? Kalinske, Olafsson, and Schulhoff were seated by a window overlooking the city, where they enjoyed an elegant seafood meal with a fine Chardonnay. They started off the evening by sharing rehearsed chapters from their individual life stories, and eventually progressed to sharing impromptu anecdotes from their travels around the world. Somewhere between 5 and 10 bites into their main course, though, the conversation shifted to business matters. So, Schulhoff began. Olaf tells me that you plan to turn the video game industry on its head. That's the plan, Kalinske said with a smirk. Excellent, Schulhoff said. That's what I like to hear. The fact is, we strongly believe in the business, Olafsson clarified. The games themselves I could take or leave, but the industry as a whole, there will be a gold rush. In many ways, Kalinske said, it has already begun. True, true, Olafsson said, nodding. Perhaps my vantage point is a bit affected by Sony's angle on all of this. Kalinske leaned back in his chair to get a better look at both of his hosts. So tell me then, what is the ideal scenario for Sony? Schulhoff gladly fielded the question. When I first began at Sony in the late 70s, we made our bones selling televisions and stereos. We did quite well. Well enough that it would have been easy to stick our heads in the sand and keep cashing paychecks for the foreseeable future. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? The three used the rhetorical pause to take a long sip from their wine glasses. After a satisfied sigh, Schulhoff continued. But then in 1978, an audio engineer named Nobutoshi Kiara invented a small portable stereo that allowed people to listen to music anywhere they went. Many questioned this logic and wondered why anybody in their right mind would possibly want to enjoy music outside the living room. Sony, however, didn't bat an eyelash and moved full steam ahead with this device called the Walkman. Without any need to take the risk, we pushed all of our chips to the middle and changed the way that music is enjoyed around the world. I remember getting my first Walkman, Kalinske said nostalgically. Of course you do, Schulhoff said.
Because if Sony does something, we do it memorably. The whole nine yards or nothing at all. Olufsen smiled.
I believe the popular parlance is go big or go home.
It's true, Shuloff said. Columbia Pictures, Compact Discs, CBS Records. You don't need to pay me a resume, Klinsky said. I'm already thoroughly impressed. But I'd like to know where Sega fits into all of this. Is Sony looking to make an acquisition?
Not at all, Shuloff said, shaking his head. I truly believe in synergy. Not the bullshit buzzword version of the term, but the real-life implications of finding situations of mutual benefit.
Olufsen elaborated.
Sega has the experience and is gaining the credibility. Sony has the tech and financial resources. But what we share is the intelligence to realize that multimedia is the inevitable future of entertainment. On that note, is it safe for me to assume that Sega has some kind of CD-based gaming system in the works?
Kalinske considered a vague response, but decided to reveal his hand. If there was any chance of building something with Sony, he couldn't start with smoke and mirrors.
Yes, that's accurate, he said. Sega is planning a CD attachment to Genesis.
How far along is it? Olufsen said.
Nearing the end, Kalinske said.
We want to go to market in late 92.
Sega will beat the drum about this at CES in Vegas.
That's a fair assumption.
Olufsen pursed his lips, calculating the ramifications.
Good. That's exactly what Sega ought to be doing, he said. And now that we know hardware needs are off the table, then any convergence between ourselves would be focused on software.
I hear that's where the money is anyway, Shuloff chimed in.
Olufsen subtly nodded to himself.
Is it also safe for me to assume that with the Genesis surging and all hands on deck to support the system, there is an increased need for outside parties to provide Sega with CD-based software?
Definitely, Kalinske said. I won't even consider bringing a CD add-on to America until we have the right software in place.
Olufsen looked at Shuloff, hinting that there was potentially something here.
They paused again for a bite or two of their delicious seafood dinner before Olufsen spoke up once more.
We're obviously not at a place to jump into anything of substance here, he said. But we have no reservations saying that we like you. And I believe that feeling is mutual.
Kalinske nodded. It certainly was.
So we're two teens in love, Olufsen mused. Ready to offer the world to each other, but any consummation would require parental approval.
And Japanese parents have a reputation for being strict, Kalinske added.
Tell me about it, Shuloff murmured, shaking his head.
Nevertheless, Olufsen concluded, with some massaging, I think that there very well could be a way for Sony to help supply Sega's software needs.
I'll work on things from my end, Kalinske commented.
And we'll do the same, Shuloff replied.
Fantastic, then, Olufsen said.
But I would like to note, in the spirit of complete and utter honesty, that a working relationship would likely not preclude the possibility of Sony one day looking to get into the console business.
Kalinske shrugged. I wouldn't expect it any other way. But for now, I think we both have a lot to gain by holding hands. Down the road, maybe that's something we explore together, or maybe we go our separate ways. But I'm okay with that maybe.
Us two, Shuloff said.
Good, Kalinske said, and raised his glass, prompting Olufsen and Shuloff to do the same.
To maybe. And all the wonderful possibilities that the word may create.
With full bellies and wine smiles, they clinked glasses. Three men who had spent most of their lives believing they were destined to conquer the world, and who had become further convinced of this notion with age. They sipped their drinks, excited by the prospect of building an empire together, but each fully aware of that razor-thin line between friends and enemies.
Chapter 20. Worth Waiting For.
Thick trees with raggedy brown leaves. A graying road.
and another parking lot. Although the view from Kalinske's new office could hardly compare to the princely panorama from atop the building where he'd dined with the Sony executives a few months earlier, it felt a good deal more satisfying. This was a view that he and his